answers tonight. Bianca thanked us for our patience. I feel we should thank her and Dania for their patience and kindness. They're also without water, but have the added responsibility of doing what they can for us all. With metta and applause to them. Very good. And it looks like we've got water again. As last week, January the 16th, marked the 20th anniversary of Ajahn Chah's death, could you please share with us what were the most important things you learned from him? No offence, but you could please not answer by telling the Ajahn Chah asking you why story. Thank you. I just told this to some person that whenever I made a mistake or any other monk made a mistake, Ajahn Chah would never scold you. He'd never tell you off. Every time you made a mistake, he'd burst out laughing. So we often made mistakes, so we kept our teacher very happy. Now that's a wonderful way. Somebody makes a mistake, stop scolding them, laugh, because you're laughing at life. People make mistakes, and when they do make mistakes, it's very, very funny. For example, the first year I was with Ajahn Chah, I was still having to learn Thai. And sometimes the words are so similar. It happened that I needed some soap, because in those days there was very little things in our monasteries. It really was an incredibly poor monastery. And to have a big water jar, when people offered things, they'd put it in there. And if you wanted something, Ajahn Chah would see if there was anything there, and any soap in there, and if there was, he gave it to you. So, I went in there to ask for some soap. However, the Thai word for soap is sabu, and I said sapo. It's very close, but sapo meant pineapple. And so my teacher said, what? Say, what do you want pineapple for? He's very kind, and I said, to wash. And he almost fell off his chair, and he never let me forget that Ajahn Brahm is a monk who washes with pineapples. So he caused an awful amount of happiness for a monk. So when somebody does something wrong and you see them, don't scold them. Just laugh. Life is funny when you make mistakes. So that's what I learned from Ajahn Chah. When things go wrong, you laugh, instead of getting angry and swearing. So, we had no water for a couple of days. That's more like it. Are there other ways of calming down the mind other than meditation? Yeah, Valium? Perhaps as a precursor to meditation. Are you simplifying life, sila, dana, etc.? Yes. Because sila is when you do lots of good works. I mean, you're a good person. And that means you don't have to worry about all these things which, you know, you may have done in the past. If you're very virtuous, it gives you a very bright, happy mind. And dana is giving away all your money, because it's such a worry having money, and you have to worry about where to invest it and where to get it from and all that sort of stuff. That's why I just put it in the donation box and have done with it. No, just keep enough for yourself. But it is that whenever you do a good act, this is an important point, whenever you're kind, even when you're meditating and you see that somebody's left something, so their glasses, so you take it back to their room for them. Or if somebody's a bit sick, yeah, it's your meditation retreat, but you look after them, bring them a cup of tea in bed or something. When you're kind to people like that, that gives you this beautiful inner energy. And that makes it so much easier to meditate. Because sometimes, you know, you wonder, why is it that sometimes, that, you know, you're sitting there, you're watching the breath, why can't I watch the breath? You just need inspiration, a bit of joy. And helping others gives you really lots and lots of joy. It makes life fun. And when the mind is bright with lots of joy and fun, it's very easy to meditate. So just being kind to one another. It may be the last piece of bread, and somebody looks at it, and you know they want it, so you have it, go on. And a nice little small kind of thing like that, when you meditate, you find it's easier to watch the breath, or whatever else you're watching. It works. Little bits of kindness and joy makes it, your mind gets brighter, you got more energy, more mindfulness. So that's why it's really nice to be kind and compassionate. And those of you who think, no, it's my meditation. So I need my one piece of toast, because without that piece of toast, my meditation, I won't get my jhana. That's just what I need. And I've got to sit right here and somebody else is encroaching on me or whatever. Mind's like that, which is just so fault-finding and controlling. You never get anywhere in meditation. I've seen people like that. They just want it just so. And they leave all these questions. That girl in my room, she snores. That boy keeps on banging the door. Can you please tell him they're spoiling my jhanas? Those sorts of mind never get anywhere. So you have to have a very nice, kind and open mind and a forgiving mind. And then the meditation gets very, very easy. So that general idea of being a really good, kind, easygoing, happy person, that's what you can do and makes meditation very, very easy. Every time I've done a really nice, good act, it's so easy to meditate. I have slowly but surely been letting go of botherations. That's a good word, botherations. But there is one in particular that I have realized is not in my hands to let go of. It is somebody else's problem with me. They must let go of, but it still affects me greatly. What do I do? My goodness, what do you mean? It's your problem, not yours. If it affects you, it's your problem. So you just let it go. Just say, not my problem. So it is in your hand. What other people say, what other people do, their attitudes, whether they live, they die, whatever they do, that really is their karma. But some of us are so stupid that what happens is we take other people's karma and we put it in our own hearts. Other people are suffering. And you know, we put that suffering in our hearts. Other people do bad things or good things, we put that in our hearts. Now that's their karma. Leave them alone. So when it comes to the karma, you know, you can be independent. When you really want to, you can go out there and serve and help. But in serving and helping, there's Ajahn Chah's great simile. He said, when I was a young monk, said, one day, you know, that all you monks, and if you stay long enough, you'll be teaching, you'll be interviewing people, you'll be counseling them, and they'll be telling you all their problems. But he said that when they're telling your problems, you listen to them and you care for them. You don't keep anything. So the way you could do that, he said, imagine you're a dustbin. So on all those interviews, in morning and afternoon, I'm the dustbin. And you come and put all your stuff in me, all the meditation, life problems, and all the other problems. So you just dump. But the most important thing when you're a dustbin is to be a dustbin with a hole in the bottom. So you don't keep anything. They dump on you and it goes right through. So when the next person comes for interview, you're empty and open and ready to receive all of their rubbish too. And the next person comes in, you're open again. And when the interviews are gone, you go back to your room and you leave everything right there. You don't take anything back with you. That means that you can care for people, but they don't affect you. So this is what we have to do, because the botheration, you say, it's not in your hands to let go of. It is. The whole of this world is in your hand to let go of. And it's the old thing, if it's something to do, do it. If it's nothing to do, do nothing. And when you're meditating here, when you're sitting on your chair or your cushion, it's nothing to do. Your duties and responsibilities have now ended. This is time for meditation, for peace, for freedom. And if you think that you're not doing your responsibilities for other people, you are. Because give yourself an hour of meditation, a couple of hours of meditation, whatever. You now have the resources to really be able to serve and help and understand. But if you go out helping other people and helping other people, and you know you're the trouble. You know, you've got no wisdom, no compassion, that just really on edge all the time. You create more problems in the world. So learn how to meditate, be peaceful, be still, be compassionate, be wise, and then you can really help others. So that's why I never feel at all guilty when I'm sitting here just doing absolutely nothing, or up in my room meditating, because I realize that this is the best I can do for other people. So you do that. So whatever the botheration is, you just let it go. It's not them, it's you. The similar, another sort of simile, well, Ajahn Chah used to say, I keep quoting him, because he gave some very, very good one-liners. Whenever there was a noise, right, they used to have these parties in the village. And when they had a party, now this was in the northeast of Thailand, they were Laotian rather than Thais. When they had a party, it went on for 3 days. And they started finishing about 2 o'clock. That's when they got tired. And they drank as well. And that's when they stopped. And they started again the following morning for another couple of days. That's actually what happened. And here's a little interesting story. One of my friends, gives you an idea of, like, you know, these Laotian people. There's two little stories here. He was in the town of Luang Prabang, which was the second city in Laos during the war with the communists. And it's the second city. He was staying in there, and he was having a lunch, you know, in one of these cafes, you know, bamboo and thatch, you know, really nice food, very cheap. And he was sitting at a table having his lunch, and he saw another table, the government soldiers, you know, with their M16s against the wall. They were having their lunch. And then he almost dove under the table when he saw the communist troops coming, the communist soldiers. Remember, this is Vietnam War. This was in Laos. The Pathet Lao came into the same restaurant. But they just got on another table. They put their guns on the side wall. Because in Laos, war stops for lunch. And the two opposite sides were in the same restaurant, having lunch at different tables. And they were fighting each other. And that's like the Laos. And he said that he stayed there after the communists took over. And he was an English guy, and he went to a public school. So just a few days after, maybe a few weeks after the communists took over, because there was lots of disruption, he woke up in the middle of the night, and his house, he found a little burglar, a young boy, about 14 or 15, sort of trying to steal things from his house. So what he did, being an English public school boy, he put him over his knee and spanked him. That's what he did. And the boy complained to the communists. You're not supposed to do that. So the guy got summoned to the head communist cadre in the second city of Luang Prabang. And he was really scared. And he said, what are you? And he really was wondering, they could do anything to him. They could kill him, torture him, whatever. But these were Laotian communists. And he said, no, this is a new state of affairs. You're not allowed to do that anymore. You can't take the law into your own hands. You let us deal with this. But because you did this, we're going to have to punish you. And he thought, oh my goodness, what is it going to be? And he said, your punishment is you have to throw a party for 3 days and pay for everything. And he said, yeah, I'll do that. So he threw a big party for 3 days, all these communist soldiers getting drunk with him, having a great old time. And he said, that was the northeast Laos. You've got a couple over there, you know what I'm talking about. They're just so easygoing. And, they don't take anything that seriously, which I think is a beautiful part of them. But anyway, when they had the parties, 3 days, and so we used to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they didn't stop their party till 2 o'clock. And you could hear the noise so loud, so you know where you could sleep. So after a couple of days of that, we asked the headman, look, can you give us a couple of hours sleep? Turn the music down at 1 or something. No. They wouldn't listen to us. So what we thought, the monks met together, we thought, we'll go and see Ajahn Chah. Now, he's a big monk. They're afraid of him. If he tells them to turn the music down at 1 o'clock, then they will. So we asked Ajahn Chah, can you please tell these villagers, to give us some sleep? The noise is disturbing us. And that's when he said his beautiful word, monks, it's not the noise disturbing you. It's you who are disturbing the noise. The thing is, he was so wise, you can't argue with things like that, because that was so deep, and it really is true. The noise never disturbs you, it's you disturb the noise. Someone bangs the door, that's just noise, that's nature. But you disturb it. Who did that? They shouldn't do that. We should get some rubber things so it doesn't bang anymore. We should get a revolving door. Now you're disturbing the noise. So when you understand that, people don't disturb you. You disturb them. If you understand that, you understand how to let go. Thank you for your excellent teachings. Yes, I agree with that. Can one become enlightened by practice of breath meditation alone? If not, when do we have to practice meditation on other feelings, mind, and mind objects? Yeah, of course you can become enlightened by practicing breath meditation alone. If you look at Anapanasati Sutta 118 Majjhima Nikaya, you see it says that verbatim. The Buddha said, if you practice the Anapanasati, it fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness, just doing Anapanasati. And if that fulfills the seven enlightenment factors, so that's a complete practice all by itself. Have a look there. It actually says that. That practice Anapanasati fulfills everything and gets you all the way to enlightenment. So easy. This is the way. Normally, I distract myself from disturbing emotions, thoughts, etc. If I'm mindful of them, I assume they will go away sooner. Why does mindfulness work like this and help in letting them go? If I'm mindful of them, I assume they will go away sooner. Yeah. It's if you're distracting yourself from these disturbing emotions, thoughts, it depends actually what you're distracting them with. If you're actually doing what they call substitution, you know, maybe like doing like that mantra, then that will actually slow them down very fast. But again, if you're mindful of them, they will go away sooner because all those distracting thoughts, they've got a cause. What feeds them? And it's always some form of negativity. I don't want to be here. I'm just hot. I'm just tired. I want to go somewhere else. There's always some negativity which makes you move. If you're perfectly happy and content and really want to be here, then there is no distracting thoughts at all. So understand it's just the negativity. Wanting to control things, get rid of things, you're wanting more things. That is the cause of all these disturbing emotions and thoughts. When you see their cause and stop their cause, just let them be. Leave them alone. And then they just disappear all by themselves. So just like, you know, you can put the brake on the car, but it's much better to turn the gas off. And then the car can't go anywhere. So that's what happens. Turn off the gas of discontent. When I start fully aware of the present moment, my face starts itching. Why is this normal? What should I do? That's very easy to make a joke about that, but this is actually a very good point. It is when do you become aware of the present moment that your awareness gets stronger and it amplifies feelings. Feelings which have been swamped by many other sensations. Now you can feel them more fully. So there is that stage. Your whole body tends to itch like ants crawling over them. And things are very, very strong. They're amplified. And that's a very good stage of meditation. It's not unpleasant. It's just interesting. But you haven't had that before. And just stay there. Don't do anything. And after a short while, the whole body disappears. So all that really is your mindfulness is increasing. Those feelings were always there, but now you're awake enough, aware enough, you're seeing them with greater intensity. Just like I said, walking up the hillside, you start to see the trees and the grass and the flowers with greater intensity. So you're feeling the body with greater intensity. That's all it is. So it is normal. Just leave it alone. If it gets really too bad, yeah, you can scratch, but a lot of times just leave it alone and it will just vanish and you get very peaceful. Could you further clarify the concept of control? Where does it come from? Are there different types? Why do we need to feel in control and control? Number one is because you have been conditioned and brainwashed by culture, by education to control. You may have been like this boy when you were in grade one and they asked you, or this little girl, what did you think of that? And you said, nothing. And they punished you for that. You could have been an enlightened being very early on in life. And you were forced to think and have opinions and do things. You may be one of these people, these little kids who just looked up at the sky and just enjoyed the stars and having a wonderful time. But then they said, no, you've got to sort of answer the questions. And sometimes the education is just one size fits all. And that's one of the big problems. So where control comes from? Number one, we're taught to control. And you are praised if you can control well, if you succeed. You work hard and you get prizes. You know, you restrain yourself, you control yourself, and you get sort of accolades from your parents and others. But then after a while, you just become this terrible control freak. And that becomes a lot of suffering. And the reason why now we find it hard to let go of control is because of fear. We think if we don't control, then everything will go all wrong. If we don't control our kids, they will become monsters. You have to trust your kids, not control them, which is really important. Because have you been a kid and got controlled? You just rebel. If your parents trust you, a lot of times the kids live up to that trust. Thank you, parents. You know, you're trusting me. I'm going to try and do my best. I'm going to make mistakes sometimes, but I have to learn. You control those kids. It's like, I say, putting a bird in a cage. And the bird's in a cage. Yeah, it doesn't get out to any mischief inside the cage, but one day you're going to leave that cage door open. It's going to fly away. It's never going to come back again. If you trust the bird, leave the cage door open. If it wants to go flying out, off you go. It's such a nice cage, such a nice family. It always comes back again. Because you don't need to control it. In the same way with emotions as well. Your mind, don't put it in a cage. Otherwise, the first time it has an opportunity to fly away, it goes off into all sorts of fantasies and dreams and stuff like that. So don't control it. Here's this nice story. In the northeast of Thailand, every morning during the dry season, the farmers or the kids would take the water buffalo out to the fields to graze. And the water buffalo are usually very placid animals. But when they get spooked, I don't know why they get afraid, but sometimes they get afraid. They put their head up high and they run. And there was a man who was taking his water buffalo out past our monastery. And this was in Thailand. And the water buffalo got spooked, started to run away, and this stupid man tried to hold it back. Now, fortunately, the string which he was using to lead the water buffalo wound around the top of his finger and pulled the top of his finger off. And so, you know, that's where we saw him. He came into this monastery with this bit of bone and half a finger and blood all over the place. It looked really, you know, gory, but, you know, it's only top of a finger. Sort of, you know, took him to the hospital, you know, patched him up. He was fine. It's not life-threatening. It just made him eat it to scratch, you know, because of the bone. <sort of. laughs> But he was fine. But that became this simile which we used a lot. What is stronger, a buffalo or a human being? It's obvious who's going to win that contest, the water buffalo. So if your water buffalo wants to run away, let it go. Then you don't lose a finger, or even worse, let it run away. It never runs far, maybe a couple of hundred meters, 300 meters, then it stops. Because, you know, it belongs to the family. You know, this is its people, look after it and care for it. It's not going to run too far. And when it's calmed down, then you walk after it, and then you pull it back. And that's how you look after the water buffalo. And that's how you look after your mind. Now, sometimes it's like a buffalo, isn't it? It's crazy. Let it go. Off you go. Because if you try and stop it, it pulls off your finger, pulls off lots of stuff. Let it go. Off you go. Go on. And then afterwards, when it calms down, then you walk after it, and then you can take it wherever you want to. Sometimes wives are like that. If you try and rein them in, you're going to lose a lot of fingers. Let them go. Husbands, kids, let them go. And when they calm down, then you can rein them in. That's the way to do it. And I told that story some time ago, and it's this similar story. It's a classic story, which is about meditation, about letting go. A lady here in Perth, whose 5 or 6 year old son decided he didn't love his mum anymore and wanted to leave home. That story. It's one of the classic stories, if you haven't heard it already. Mum, I don't love you anymore. I want to leave. And what did Mum do? Help pack the kids' bags. Okay, darling, I'll help you pack. So went into the bedroom, had a little suitcase and packed, you know, the teddy bears, whatever the kid liked. They're all the important stuff of life. And then the mum said, before you go, I'll make you a sandwich, you know, what he liked, you know, for your lunch. So I put the sandwich in a brown paper bag. and they had his suitcase in the other, and the kid at the front door, "Bye bye, son, have a really lovely life." And the kid walked down, you know, the little path to the gate, you know, leaving home for the first time. And he turned the corner, and of course he's only a 5 or 6 year old kid. Just before it got to the end of the street, was terribly homesick. Just turned around, came through the garden gate, and his mother was still waiting there, hadn't moved. "Welcome home, son." Now that was a very wise mother. And that's actually how you deal with your mind as well. If your mind says, "Right, that's it, I'm leaving, I hate you," and it goes off to all sorts of fantasies or dreams, "Okay, bye-bye, help pack the mind's bags, give it a sandwich, bye-bye, go and be crazy, it's all right with me." And then your mind comes back to you very quickly. So that's, you don't fight and control things. And that's the reason why people get into a lot of trouble. Don't use willpower. Use wisdom power in life and especially in meditation. How do you meditate on the heat? Can I lie down like a sleeping Buddha while listening to your talk to enter samadhi? You will enter snoring samadhi. So, in the heat. Now, what is actually heat? If it's heat, "I don't like this, it's hot, I should have aircon, I don't want this, why did I get a retreat at this time of the year, why don't they have windows, why don't they have fans, why don't they have..." That is the heat. Or the thinking. So, as I said, just with the sound, it's not the sound disturbs you, it's you disturb the sound. It's not the heat disturbs you, it's you disturb the heat. If you understand that, it's a brilliant teaching, because it's true. The heat is just the heat. But when you start complaining, that becomes the problem. So anyway, don't lie down like a sleeping Buddha. Because, you know, the Buddha's, you know, if you shave your hair, then okay. Just like the Buddha. What's the difference between jhana, samadhi and nirvana? Thank you. You will soon find out. No, jhana... Jhana is samasamadhi, they call that the really good stillness. So there's all types of stillness. Samadhi is stillness, jhana is a very deep state of stillness, and nirvana is what happens when you become still long enough. You vanish, you disappear. Most venerable Ajahn Brahm, that's very good, I've gone up in the world. I was venerable Ajahn Brahm, now I'm the most venerable Ajahn Brahm. Maybe next year I'll become the extreme venerable Ajahn Brahm. And then the most extreme. These titles are really good. On what stage to become a Sotapanna? Stream mentor on achieving the jhanas? No. Then you can get the jhanas and still not be a stream winner. Just like Devadatta. You know, those of you who know your Buddhist history. He had jhanas, but he wasn't even a stream winner. No. You need the jhanas to be a stream winner. I say, other people don't say that. I say you need them, and you need some wisdom. The two come together. The simile I gave was the jhanas are like the flame. The wisdom is like the gunpowder. You put those two together, and then you get the explosion of enlightenment. Stream winner is the first stage of enlightenment. But I'll probably talk about that later on. Is singing an indulgence in force or unnecessary speech? Is singing an indulgence? It depends. Know what you sing and how you sing. Most of you have got probably terrible voices, so it really is an indulgence. And it's totally unnecessary. So, the standard is, if you can improve on the silence, then you can sing. But if you can't improve upon the silence, shut up. If jhanas could only be attained by letting go of ego, how come Devadatta was able to attain jhanas? Oh, this was a premonition here. Okay, the jhanas can be attained by letting go of ego temporarily, but you still got it when you come out again. That's what happened to Devadatta. He got into these jhanas and he thought just how enlightened he was. This is one of the problems with the jhanas. It is that they would have to try to come in. Now, this is serious stuff, not joking. If you get into a jhana, it is very powerful, very blissful. And if you don't have a good teacher, sometimes you come out afterwards and think you're enlightened. Because sometimes your hindrances are gone for days, weeks, sometimes even years. You're perfectly peaceful, very happy, having a wonderful time. And sometimes you can think that that must be full enlightenment, because that's what it feels like. That's why even the Buddha said the happiness of a jhana, he called it sambodhisukha, like enlightenment happiness. It's a taste of what it's like to be totally free and at peace, you know, just full of love and peace and happiness. And so it can appear to be the same, but the effect of the jhanas just wears off after a little while. So, you know, you've got a taste, but you've got to get some insight, which will come usually quite naturally. So the jhanas are brilliant, but there's more to be done. A real life example is a friend of mine who says she can regularly get into jhanas and has consulted a monk, your former colleague, here in fact, who confirmed her meditation experience was a jhana. Oh, I've got to find out who that actually was. But to me, her personality seems quite markedly control freaky, and her ego is none too small. How is it possible she can get into deep meditation? Perhaps she practiced them a lot in previous lives, or she has this natural ability. It's usually, that seems a bit suspicious to me, because if a person does get into deep meditation, they're not control freaks. You can't get into jhana by controlling. You get so far, and as you come across a brick wall, you have to let go. I say that because you can watch your breath. You can really watch your breath with full energy and effort and not let it go, being a lot of willpower. And you can even get the nimittas coming up through willpower, bright nimittas, but you can't take them into jhana. That's as far as you can go. You really do need to let go of the sense of self and ego to get into a jhana. So to me, that sounds more like that, you know, she hasn't got the real jhanas. You can get sort of, you know, close, but not the real thing. So I'm a bit dubious there. Ajahn, is meditation like exercise? That is, if you stop for a while, do you have to go back to square one? No, you don't have to go back to square one. You know, you've still got some residue there. The longer you leave it, the less the residue. But you always have some residue there, no matter how many years since you last meditated. Because the mind remembers. This is peaceful. This is wonderful. Which is why, yeah, there are some people who've had good meditation in their previous lives. And as soon as you start meditating, the mind remembers. And it remembers what happened in a previous life and can really get into deep meditation very quickly. Should we be overly concerned about animals' cruelty? Perhaps those bad people are reborn as animals and paying for their bad deeds. No, even if people are paying for their bad deeds, we should still be kind to them. That's like saying, oh, I break my leg. So, no, I break my leg. It must be some bad karma. So don't call the ambulance, because that means I'm not really paying for my bad karma. Of course you call an ambulance. Of course you take a Panadol if you've got a headache. You don't think, I've got a headache, I've got to endure this, I've got to wear off my bad karma. That really is stupid. It's your good karma that you can have a Panadol. It's your wonderful good karma. There's ambulances here. You can call them. So it's the animals' very good karma that's got people who care. So we should be concerned about animal cruelty and all cruelty, just the same as we are concerned about any injuries to ourselves. We can't be perfect and stop cruelty in this world. We can't stop injuries, but we can lessen them. However you can lessen them, brilliant. To Ajahn, this is all very well. Oops. Oh. This is all very well having a lovely meditation retreat for meditating, but how can I translate this back to the real world? What do you mean the real world? This is the real world. Out there is a false world where I live next to a really busy, noisy road. Just don't go back. Stay here. Where I live next to a really busy, noisy road. Live with people who like to have the TV blaring, etc. You can actually just, what can you do with a TV? You can actually put it out in the middle of that busy road. And squashed by one of those trucks. How can I make meditation more of an everyday experience rather than just an every now and then one? It's very hard to get a monk a present they appreciate. And I had my birthday last August, and they got me a present which was the first time in years, something I can really use and was really helpful. And this is noise equalizing headphones, because I go traveling a lot. And I know, first of all, I thought, these won't really work. But the first time I went on an aircraft after getting those, I put them on my ears, and it just gave me so much peace. And I could actually meditate on top, you know, on the aircraft with all the kids, you know, screaming and things going on. It was brilliant. It wasn't totally silent, but it was enough of the noise taken out that it reminded me of like caves, solitude. And so it was brilliant. So if you've got TVs and stuff like that, get one of those noise equalizing headphones. You can sit in your house, nice and peaceful, and it's just like being in a forest somewhere. So that's a practical way of doing it. That's a very, very good karma to get me those little headphones, because I really enjoy them. So that's one of the things you can do. The other thing, of course, is move. There's lots of other places you can stay. Look how peaceful this place is over here. It's not that far out from town, an hour. So you can find nice, quiet places to live. Ajahn Brahm, thank you for teaching us and for this great place. I was curious about a meditation that occurred Saturday evening. As the mind was getting still, listening to the questions and answers, there was a sense of space that everything was getting further and further for me. As my body was disappearing, everything seemed miles away. Please excuse me, but I'm trying to make these questions really interesting. And I was in the center. Normally my mind gets still. There isn't a sense of space, but rather bliss and brightness. But it's still a beautiful idea that there's a sense of space and everything was getting further and further away. That's just another way of perceiving, you know, peace and disappearance and letting go. So all of this is very, very good stuff. The mind is deciding to see things in different ways. So remember, when you get that mental world, you know, you're in the mind, the way you can perceive these experiences is many, many ways you can experience them. And experiencing like space and things becoming distance and being free, that's really beautiful stuff. So wonderful. Sometimes you get bliss, sometimes you get a sense of space. Sounds good to me. Ajahn, you have given Dhamma Loka talks on Buddhism and science, politics and psychology, etc. But could you please talk about the creative arts sometimes? This is creative. Do artistic geniuses, Bach, Michelangelo, Shakespeare, etc., take rebirth from the gods that delight in creating? Quite like it. That's an interesting question, because that idea of creativity. Now, I was never very musical, but I remember just like sometimes, I'm just being personal here, sometimes in mathematics, sometimes you could create a formula. You could find a different way of sort of answering these questions. And that was very creative. And there was a few times, you know, just I was so inspired by just the creativity of the mind. And it was like, you know, the music of numbers. So sometimes that made me cry. And many other sort of music also made me cry. It's so beautiful. And there are such things as artistic geniuses, and how they actually create is really an interesting part of the mind. People keep saying, no, that you don't create anything. It's all just repeated stuff. But that's not true. You can create totally original things. And how do you actually do that? To be original, you have to totally divorce your mind from everything you've ever learned and known. All the old stuff has to vanish. You understand what that means? Present moment awareness. Silence. Because all the language is old stuff. You've got to totally free your mind of all the past and all the future. Make it silent. And in that silence, that's where creativity comes from. You know, a lot of times when I give talks, you know, that's how I give talks. I make my mind totally silent, don't plan anything, in the moment. And a few times I've given talks, especially to the monks, things have come up. You know, I don't know where they come from, but, you know, I've cried giving talks. It's amazing sort of, I get sort of inspired by what just came out of my mouth. And then I don't know where it came from. But it's beautiful stuff. So I can appreciate some of the creativity. But of course, to create, especially in music, you know, you've got to take risks and take chances. Not just do more of the same, but do things completely differently, which is the hardest thing to do, to let go of the safe ground of all you've learnt and do things in a totally different way. And that's the same with like creating sort of enlightenment. One of my other sayings is never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. All your learning, even what you've learned here, what you've heard from me, what you've read in the books, never allow that to stand in the way of truth. If truth is something which is imminent, right here, right in front of you, and sometimes all that you've heard and learned, that can block that truth. And it blocks creativity as well. So that's a beautiful way just to totally let go. Do creative arts have a role to play in spiritual life? Well, they essentially refine sensual pleasure of sounds cognizable by the ears, sights cognizable by the eye, ideas cognizable by the mind, etc. Many thanks. No, I think they do have a place. That's why traditionally, you know, the arts and religion have always been very closely connected. But how they're connected, I don't know. They can very much sort of just take over. And people go to the churches just to sing. And they've got some great gospel in those churches. Even I'm not a Christian, but I love gospel. But, you know, is that really just, you know, what the religion's all about? But, you know, the music can inspire, it can uplift you, it can really get you into incredibly blissful states. Fine. But then stop the music and just carry on. The music, the arts can get you so far. But then you have to let it go. That's a hard one. So yeah, I'm sure that there'd be many, especially as Buddhism starts to get stronger in countries like Australia, there'll be more people who will be using their meditation in the arts and the creative arts and coming up with some interesting stuff. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can you please explain the view teachings of jhanas in the suttas against the Visuddhi Magga? Okay, the jhanas in the suttas are very, very easy. They're repeated so many times. And the jhanas in the suttas, they always say the five jhanas. Sorry, there actually is a five jhanas in the suttas. There's a one and a half jhana between the first and the second. And they're all basically, you know, as I said this morning, vivicheva kamehi, having abandoned, separated yourself from the five senses. That's what that word means. Kamehi means from the five senses. Now, with no of the hindrances, that's the akusalehi dhammehi. And the Visuddhi Magga, actually, though, I will confess that I've never read the Visuddhi Magga. People actually say, oh, Ajahn Brahm's teachings are all from the Visuddhi Magga, but actually I've never read the thing. I refused to read it because I wanted just to stay with the suttas. But the Visuddhi Magga also apparently says, you know, separated from the five senses and also uses these lights, these nimittas. So the suttas, just follow the suttas, because even the Visuddhi Magga is a commentary. And that was written about 1,000 years after the time of the Buddha. Some of what it says is beautiful. One of the nicest things in the Visuddhi Magga, which, you know, I heard about, read, was that beautiful poem, "The path is, but no traveller on it is seen." Just that much shows you how to meditate. If you're travelling, going somewhere, making it happen, there's no path, you get nowhere. So the traveller, you know who that traveller is. Now this being inside, you can, you know, identify with that word traveller, the person inside is meditating. When that traveller vanishes, then the path is just manifest, it's easy. When you do it, you shake the Bodhi tree, then the mangoes don't fall. When you travel, there's no path. The path is, but no traveller on it, you see. Now that really was good stuff. So a lot of the commentaries, they actually, what happened with the commentaries, that by the time the commentaries were being written, the Abhidharma was very, very strong. And so a lot of the commentaries started to interpret things according to the Abhidhamma rather than according to the suttas. And they made many, many mistakes there. So as far as the jhanas were concerned, though, that wasn't really mentioned too much in the Abhidhamma. So the suttas and the Suttimagga were pretty much in line, as far as I know, with the jhanas. Is that okay? Does anyone want to ask another question about that? Okay. Lots more to go. I have a few questions. Have you strategically placed the weirdest spiders that look like spiny red crabs, topped with mustard and bird poo, in the forest so we can't go for walks, instead must meditate in the hall? These are not weird spiders. These are Buddhist spiders. They're vegetarians. They're not interested in you. So you just go for a walk in there, like spiny red crabs topped with mustard and bird poo. No, just go. You enjoy yourself. What kind of spider weaves a 2-meter long web across a path? What? I found it very funny. I don't know. Ask it. Would you scream if you walked into a spider's web? Monks don't see. Have you ever heard me screaming? It's like how the Metta Sutra attracts people. Is there a chant which would repel spiders? Thank you. Use reverse psychology. Say, come spider, come spider, come spider. Nice spider. Lovely spider. May all spiders be happy and well. And that... What? No, we share the forest here with all these other animals, and they're all important here. And, you know, those animals, they never sort of harm you. If you don't harm them, they never harm you. It's really wonderful living over in the road in Bodhinyana Monastery for the last 28 years. All the animals have got used to us, and we've got used to them. So we've got this wonderful sense of harmony with the animals, the snakes, the spiders, the lizards, all these other animals, especially the kangaroos. But no, you go over there, the kangaroos know they're safe over in Bodhinyana Monastery. They still haven't got that sense of safety here in Jhana Grove yet. That's why you don't see many kangaroos around here. You go over there, they're just grazing, minding their own business. They look up, oh, it's just a human being. They carry on grazing. They don't care at all about you guys. Isn't that wonderful? They're in harmony. So same with the spiders. As they're doing their thing, just leave them alone. They're perfectly safe. I believe you have been on a pilgrimage to visit Buddhist sites in India. What are your impressions of the Buddha as a historical figure and the times he lived in? Born to a Buddhist family, I've been told so many different stories as a child. I would like to hear a more believable story about the Buddha. Look, because I was a Westerner, not born in a Buddhist family at all, many of that stuff which you hear, you didn't believe in at all. But the longer I become a monk, the more some of these amazing things, maybe they are true. Even the idea of the Buddha being born and saying, speaking, this is my last life. And that's supposed to be, you know, in the tradition. Have you ever seen a baby speak? They have. And I've collected all these stories of children who could speak when they were born. And the first time, many years ago here, this couple came up to see me. And they were just ordinary Australian couple. And they had two kids, two sons. The new son had just come out from hospital with the mother at home. And one evening, they said to their son, I think it was Paul, so go and say goodnight to your baby, Peter, your brother. So the brother with a new baby, just out of hospital. And so Paul went over to the crib or whatever it was, leant over and said, goodnight, Peter. And Peter said, goodnight, Paul. That was really just amazing. And so the mother and the father stopped what they were doing. They couldn't believe what they'd heard. And they just stared. And without any prompting, their son Paul said it again. good night, Peter. And this time, with both of them paying 100% full attention, they saw their newborn baby son say, good night, Paul, very clearly. They weren't imagining it. They were looking, waiting, and they heard it. And of course, that freaked them out. So they weren't Buddhists, but it's interesting. They came to the Buddhist monks. You know, weird stuff belongs here. And that's a great story. When I heard that, you know, it's obviously that, you know, that's actually people from their past life. You know, they can actually be born with that degree of mindfulness. And interesting, the parents said their baby did not speak in baby voice. It was like an adult voice. And I've collected other stories. And there was another couple here in Perth, a Malaysian couple. They said that happened to them. Their baby, when it was born, spoke to them. And they didn't tell anybody because they thought that people would think they were crazy. But the best story of all happened in the United States. A baby coming in the maternity ward, coming out of the mother's womb. And you know, the doctor, the midwife, whatever else was there, they saw this. It came out straight out of the room. I think the umbilical cord was probably still attached to it. And it looked around and spoke. Straight out of the room and spoke. What I like about the story is the words it said. It came out of the room, looked around and said, oh no, not again. Oh no, not more nappies, more going to school. Brilliant. So that's how I have. So sometimes you believe that, because I never believed that when I first became a Buddhist, but all this evidence comes up, maybe it was true. But remember, a lot of this is they just exaggerate many of these stories, because that's natural. Now, this is what happens. Whenever you get a teacher, you tend to exaggerate all the things which they do. So anyway, that's one of the believable stories. I better carry on. How do we charge, energize the mind so that a clear and brighter nimitta appears? Be still. That's one of the best ways of charging it. The other way of charging it is to do good karma. Be compassionate, be kind, be generous. It gives the mind a boost. It actually does work. Where am I when I'm not here? You're somewhere else. I spend so much time there, i.e. not here, that I should at least know its location. I told you. i.e. when daydreaming, am I in a cerebral neural circuit going round in circles or some other more exotic ethereal location? You don't realize how much you can create. So you can create worlds. This is what the Buddha actually said, and it's a very powerful saying. He said, no, whatever the mind tends towards, follows, makes much of, that becomes what he called a foundation, a station of your consciousness. And you can get reborn there. You create your worlds. And that's actually quite scary sometimes. You keep thinking about things and think about things. How many of those things have you actually created? Sometimes things you're afraid of, and they come to fruition. You create those things. When you realize just how powerful that creative mind can be, you have to be very careful. So think beautiful thoughts if you want to create a beautiful world. Fascinating. So when you're daydreaming, are you in a cerebral neural circuit? You're just creating your own little world. And that's where you are. A very deep Japanese proverb. We are fools whether we dance or not, so we might as well dance. Too deep for me. It's a very deep Japanese proverb. We are fools whether we dance or not, so we might as well dance. I think that if you see me dance, I'm more of a fool when I dance. What is the you that shuts up or gets out of the way or is patient so the mind can do its stuff? Thank you, I'm confused. Self, mind, thoughts, watch it. Okay, you will find out what that you is when it disappears. That old simile of the tadpole and the frog. Tadpole can't understand what water is, but when it becomes a frog, it jumps out of the lake, something's missing. What's missing? Ah, that was water. when this idea of you has always been there, it's impossible to know what it is. That's why it's so confusing. You know, who am I? What is this? Now, what is this knowing? It's always there. You can't get any perspective. No more than a fish can know what water is. Because it's been born in water, lived all its life in water. Water's always around it. How can a fish know what water is? How can you know what you are? Until you jump out of the lake. Tadpole turns into a frog. And it's standing on the dry land. Something's missing. Something which was always there. It's not there anymore. Like you get into a jhana. Something is missing, which was always there before. You know what that is? You. That's when you find out who you are. That's very deep. I have been very curious to know what the age of the youngest and oldest layperson here is. I am aware that it does not matter at all, but why am I curious? Okay, the age of the youngest person here is 624. The oldest person. You've been many, many lifetimes. So you can't know who the oldest and layperson is. Why am I curious? Because of restlessness. It's just sometimes that when we're bored, we just look in the refrigerator to see if there's something to eat, even if we're not hungry. Apparently, on these TV channels, they've got 60 or 70 TV channels, and you still can't find anything interesting to watch. So that is why you just anything just to distract yourself. The youngest and oldest layperson here. Dear Ajahn, as you are both a physician and a Buddhist monk, a physicist, I am curious to hear your views on the benefits and limitations using meditation as a form of scientific inquiry. Actually, that is a scientific inquiry, especially into the nature of the brain and the mind. Because that's one of the things as a physicist and as a Buddhist monk. Every now and again when I see all these books on the nature of the brain and saying this part over here is responsible for this thought, this part over here is responsible for some other emotion, that is a lot of rubbish. Because there are people who've got no brain and are perfectly aware. That's why the first time was in 1981, I think, Nature. Professor John Lauber of Sheffield University. This is over 30 years ago now, so it's really, 30 years ago, it's really hard to find. But I got a copy of the original article. This Professor John Lauber from Sheffield University in the UK, his field of research was the shape of the human skull. And anybody with a deformed skull, he was going to investigate to see whether it had any effect on their health, their personality, their intelligence, or whatever. So whenever he saw someone with a slightly deformed skull shape, he'd invite them on his research program. So he saw this student. He was a graduate with honors in mathematics at Sheffield University doing research, postgrad work, sorry. And his skull was slightly misformed. So he invited him onto the study. And the first thing they did was give him a CAT scan to look at his brain. And when the results of the CAT scan came out, there was no brain. Just totally filled up with cerebral fluid. He became the boy with no brain. And he was an honours graduate in mathematics. He had no brain. All that stuff which you're supposed to have, he didn't have. And when I was talking to this GP over in Sydney, I was talking about this sort of stuff, he said he'd actually seen that sort of CT scan, it's true. And he said they did it again because they thought maybe the machine was wrong, but it's actually true. The boy with no brain. Now, to do an exercise, can you please move your head backwards and forwards? Can you hear any sloshing? Because you may also have no brain inside. And the thing that doctor told me, he said, you wouldn't believe just how much problems that is creating for science. That is threatening the egos and the research funding, billions of research funding, into the nature of the brain and the mind. He said that was conclusive evidence. There was a person with no brain, had a very well-functioning mind. What's going on? So there's many cases like that. And that's why that sometimes, that as a scientist, I realize that many people who call themselves scientists are just as dogmatic as religious nuts. They say, this is the truth, this is the way it is, and you've got to believe it or else. Yeah.
As you're looking for the
No, I'm not quite sure what happened to that guy. But there's been other experiments done. Yeah, it was in 1981. Professor Lorber retired a long time ago. But that's really been taken over by the people doing NDE experiments, near-death experiences. That's when people actually die. And the guy who started that was Professor Pim van Lommel. And when he wrote his first little research paper, that was in Lancet in 2001, I think, that really sort of caused a lot of problems for people, because he was a professor of medicine at three university hospitals in the Netherlands. And his research, we've all heard about these near-death experiences, people dying or something and floating out of the body and coming back again afterwards. And so he wanted to investigate this properly, in a very rigorous scientific study. So for his sample base, he used every person who came into three hospitals over about 2 or 3 years, who came to that hospital with cardiac arrest. That was his sample base. And those that survived, he gave questionnaires to. Just trying to find out, no leading up questionnaires, if they had any of these near-death experiences. Floating out of the body, being able to hear conversations, see medical procedures, when they were unconscious. And he also recorded, what happened in the ER room or any surgery, to make sure that if they did say they remembered anything, they could check up to see if that's what actually happened, where those conversations took place. And the result of his research, he got about 10% of his sample base, these are the ones who survived, had these near-death experiences. But the thing which he discovered, which was shocking, was the people who had those near-death experiences, that 10%, were the 10% whose brain stopped, who were brain dead. And he said that was an amazing thing, to have those near-death experiences, not just cardiac arrest, the brain has to stop as well. And when he saw it published that, the whole idea that these people were aware, they were conscious, and they had memory of what happened. And at that time, the brain was not working, totally dysfunctional. And of course, that caused a lot of problems. But that is very tough scientific evidence. I was a scientist. The science is predicated on, I think it was Francis Bacon. He was the founder of the Royal Society in London. And he was a great philosopher of science. And he put forth the way of science is a way of disproof. You put up a theory, and everybody tries to disprove it. And don't try and prove it, you try and find faults in it. He said that's the only way to move forward. If you proved it, you can't really prove it, just you haven't seen the time it doesn't work. Throwing a ball up in the air, what goes up, what goes down? Yeah, it goes up, goes down. That hasn't proved anything. But if you throw it up so fast, it goes into orbit, doesn't come down again. Now you've disproved that. You have to adapt the law. So science really should not be trying to prove things. They're getting a theory and trying your damnedest to disprove it. And if you can't, then it might be true. So one bit of disproof demolishes the theory. Yeah. The researchers, it's not really just going to change the science. With science, mostly it's egos and funding is the problem. Because people fund research because they want to sort of approve a particular outcome. And it's also egos. Even when I was at Cambridge, in those days graffiti was witty and profound. And one of the best piece of graffiti I saw in Cambridge. It was on the wall of the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge. Was this: the eminence of a great scientist is measured by the length of time they obstruct progress in their field. It's brilliant. You can see what happens there. They're the expert. You're the authority, which means you obstruct progress. You can't be wrong. You're Einstein. Einstein can't be wrong. Of course they're wrong. Ajahn Brahm, he can't be wrong. Of course he can be wrong. So be careful. Now don't get these authority figures which obstruct the truth. So I think that's one of the problems. Aha! We've got joke two. For overcoming lust. Another joke. Here we go. A girl texts her boyfriend, saying, "Oh darling, I miss you. If you are sleeping, send me all your dreams. If you love me, send me all your kisses. And if you are happy, send me all your smiles to keep me company." A few minutes later, she gets a text back saying, "Baby, I'm in the toilet. What do you want me to send you?" That's very good. Some more toilet humour. You're picking it up from me. You know, I can't forget that Ajahn Chah story, because I was there at the time. You asked for Ajahn Chah story because it was his death anniversary a few days ago. I was in a car. This is in Open the Door of Your Heart. It's a gross story, but this shows what a great teacher this man was. I was in the back of a car. There's a driver, a Thai driver. Ajahn Chah was in the passenger seat in the front. There's three of us monks in the back. We were sending one of the monks to the train station to go down to Bangkok. And there was this young novice, Gary, from New Mexico. And there was me, and there was a translator, Ajahn Prabhakara. And, you know, all those two were Americans. I was English. And Ajahn Chah turned around in the middle of the journey and looked at this young American novice and said, "You're thinking of your girlfriend back in the U.S. And Ajahn Chah was reading this guy's mind. You can imagine what it's like getting caught out like that, being busted. So his face dropped, his mouth, you know. And of course, what Ajahn Chah does was to start laughing. He said, "Doesn't matter, okay, we can help you." They said, "How?" This was through the translation. And Ajahn Chah said, "Well, next time you write to your girlfriend, you know, because you miss her so much, ask her to send something of hers, something personal, so when you miss her, you can get that out and remember your girlfriend." And this monk said, "You know, is that allowable for a monk to do that?" So, "Yeah, of course it is. Of course it is. Yeah, do that. We're compassionate. We're kind." And when I heard that, I thought, amazing. Just, you know, these monks, you know, because sometimes if you miss your girlfriend, you get a lock of her hair or something. You know, you get sort of that favorite dress or her scent. Because then, you know, when you miss her, you can sniff it and say, "Oh, that's my girlfriend." You feel good. You know what's coming next, don't you? So then Ajahn Chah said something, and the poor translator, you know, he almost died, you know, asphyxiating with laughter. And I was just waiting to find out what Ajahn Chah said, and he said, "Yeah, just ask her to send something personal of hers. Ask her for a little bottle so she can put some of her shit inside the bottle and send that to you. So when you miss her, you can take off the lid and go, 'That's my girlfriend back in those days.'" But isn't it the case? You love everything about her. Really? That was just so outrageous. It was really funny though. Okay, that's good one. Okay, about people, yeah. Is that? Okay. You mentioned about people sending themselves to lower realms. What about people who commit adultery and do things but don't think it's wrong? If you don't, actually they all know it's wrong. They don't admit it, that's all. Now it's, people get in denial, but have you ever done anything wrong? You know it's wrong. You don't have to be told that it's against the precepts or, you know, be told off or shouted at or scolded. If you do something wrong, you know it's wrong. Straight ahead, that you can get into denial. Say, it's not wrong. Everyone else does it. It's okay. But you know it's wrong and it stays with you. And that's called the guilt. And so many people have that guilt. And if it's a person commits adultery, you will have that guilt. You know it's wrong. And the thing is, what are you going to do about it? It's done now. So in Buddhism, we have to acknowledge it. Get past that denial. You've done something wrong. Come, bring it up.
And the only way you can bring it up is when there's no more fear of punishment. It's punishment creates that denial, because we're afraid of confessing, we're afraid of bringing it up, because we think we'll get punished. We're scared to be truthful. That's one of the reasons I've been going around saying this a lot recently, the last year. The reason why people lie is because it's not in their interest to tell the truth. They get punished if they tell the truth. The only way we can have truthfulness is to have amnesties and forgiveness. And that's really important. For those of you who have children, please tell your kids. If you tell mummy and daddy the truth, I don't care what it is, the worst thing you've possibly done, we will not scold you. If you're truthful, it always comes with amnesty. You know, your daughter, you may be pregnant. Son, you may be on drugs. You may go in trouble with the police. If you come and tell mummy and daddy, we will not scold you at all. Because we realize that you need someone to talk to, and that's us. If you're afraid of mummy and daddy, that you'll get punished or scolded or shouted at, you'll never come and tell us. You will never have mummy and daddy to help you get through this problem. I don't know how many girls have got pregnant and have come to me because they're afraid of telling their mummy or the father. Mummy's going to go crazy. She's going to kill me. I'm pregnant. She's going to be so ashamed. I thought, what has that mother done that you're so afraid of her? So remember, please, punishment just drives honesty away from our relationships. It's the same if you've got a relationship, husband and wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, or boyfriend, I don't care who it is. If you have a relationship, please make honesty so important. If your partner says anything and it's honest, no matter what it is, you'll forgive them. They're saying that because they realize, yes, I've made a mistake. I love you. Please help. No matter what it is. And then you understand just the power of a relationship. Honesty means amnesty. And then your partner will share with you. They won't be afraid. Have you ever done something really wrong and you really want to tell someone, especially someone who's close to you, but you're so afraid of what they will say and do? Which means it gets hidden. That's rotten when that happens. So look, you can always come and tell me no matter what you've done. And I would always say, very good. I always say that no matter what you do. So, if you've committed adultery, tell your partner. And hopefully you've got a good enough relationship, your partner will say, very good. That you've told me, you've been honest. Now look, it's a problem. It's our problem. Let's work out how we can make sure this never happens again. But no scolding, no punishment. Yeah, it does hurt. But hurting you back doesn't help. We want to work this one through so it never ever happens again. So when there is a mistake, honesty, which is bringing it up, acknowledging it, amnesty, which is forgiveness, and the next part of it is something which so rarely happens, we learn from it and grow from it so it never happens again. Dajan, I have such powerful dreams. Whenever I sleep, I feel I need to pull myself out of them each time. And in the morning, it feels more like I have experienced a night of activity, not rest. Would you please offer some wisdom and direction on this? Yeah, don't go to sleep. then you won't get so tired. Now, what you can do, you can program your mindfulness when you go to bed. So you lay down there and you just get yourself really comfortable and then you make a resolution. I will have a peaceful night's sleep. I will have a peaceful night's sleep. I will have a peaceful night's sleep. Say it to yourself 3 times with as much awareness as you possibly can in your own words and then just let it go. You'll be surprised how effective that is. It's very simple. You're giving your mind instructions on what to do just for the last moment before you go to sleep. And you carry that through with you. Reverse psychology. The disciples of a Buddhist foundation rebelled when their master says, do not. They will do it. Okay, the disciples of a Buddhist foundation rebelled when their master says, do not. They will do it. One day the old monk said, I'm going to the Pure Land soon. That was the time
the ignorant minds started to respect and see the Dhamma. Teachers, do you all see the way out? Stop feeding the ego. Leave everything alone. Sadhu, Ajahn. Don't really. Maybe it's too late in the night to get that. But anyway, see the way out. Sometimes if you say do not, they will do it. And say, I'm going to the Pure Land soon. And that was the time the ignorant mind started to respect and see the Dhamma. Okay, that's because the master was going to go soon. So they decided to get their act together quickly. Teachers, do you all see the way out? Stop feeding the ego. Leave everything alone. I agree. I think. A husband takes his wife. This is more jokes. A husband takes his wife to a fancy Italian restaurant for dinner. They both have pasta, and when it arrives, the wife accidentally sprays some tomato sauce on her white shirt. Darling, look at me. I look like a pig. Yes, you do, but you also have ketchup all over your shirt. That's high quality. Why is it so funny when we're so rude? Does insight need to come after 2 or 3 hours of meditation? Yeah, I did this one before. Can disappearing of figures come in a few minutes of closing eyes? Oh, that's right. I did this very quickly last time, and I said I'd do it slowly. Does insight need to come after 2 or 3 hours of meditation? Now, later on, I will talk about insight, and I'll show that insight happens all the time. It happens alongside stillness. So insight is always happening. Stillness is always happening. They go together. You build up the insight. The big insights happen after the deep meditations. But it doesn't come after a certain time. It's always happening. Every moment you're seeing, experiencing new things. Can disappearing of figures or bodies come in a few minutes of closing eyes? It can. Sometimes people get nimittas come in a few moments of closing your eyes, but it's unstable usually. All that really is your mind is very strong. You close your eyes and a nimitta can come up, but it doesn't last because you haven't got enough stability yet. But it can happen. All the talking and images in meditation are the same as in dreams. No, in the dreams, there's not much awareness in the dreams. This is you really are fully aware. Now really awake. In the dreams, they're a bit hazy. You're not really sure what's going on. But this has got great clarity. Are they part of our past life experiences? Usually not. In the dreams, or even the nimittas, they're just creations. If these things occur after you've emerged from jhana, these are much more true. They can be past life experiences. They can even be omens sometimes. It's very rare, but sometimes it happens. But that's usually on the way out after jhana. All those nimittas, signs and visions before you get into jhana are very unreliable. After, you can depend upon them. Is it my own soul talking, my own wisdom? Let them go and be happy. That's the best. And the last question for tonight. What's the relationship between mindfulness and kindness? Okay. They do walk together. The simile of calm and insight. I just mentioned calm and insight. Once there was this couple who were in a very close relationship together. And the girl was called Vi. Her surname was Pasana. Vi Pasana. And her partner was Sam. Sam Atta. So Vi Pasana and Sam Atta. Now Vi Pasana means insight. Sam Atta means calm. So Vi and Sam, after lunch, they decided to go for a walk up Meditation Mountain. And Sam wanted to go up Meditation Mountain because it was so peaceful and calm on the top of Meditation Mountain. Vi, she wanted to go up Meditation Mountain for the view because you could see forever on the top of Meditation Mountain. But they also had their dog called Metta. And they took the dog for a walk as well. So Metta the dog, together with the owners, Sam Atta and Vipassana, all went together up Meditation Mountain. And when they got even halfway up, it was so peaceful. Halfway up Meditation Mountain. Sam was so happy. And Vi, halfway up, she could see so far, she got out her insight camera and took insight here, insight there, to keep with her when she got back. And as for Meta the dog, Meta was starting to wag its tail more and more the higher she went up Meditation Mountain. And when they got to the top of Meditation Mountain, wow, it was so peaceful up there, so still. Sam was blissed out. But he also had a pair of eyes. He could see the view. He could see everything, the whole universe, from on top of Meditation Mountain. He could also experience the insight. And Vi, wow, she could see so far. She was taking these amazing shots. But she also experienced an incredible, profound stillness and peace on top of Meditation Mountain. And as for little Meta the dog, wow, even the dogs experience the peace. Even the dogs have eyes and can see long distances. But mostly, Meta the dog was blissing out so much. Have you ever seen a dog when it's very excited and happy? It wags its tail like it's going off, falling off, and it starts running around in circles. Blissed out of its little doggy head was Meta the dog. And the reason is because on top of Meditation Mountains, kindness, insight, mindfulness, stillness, all coexist on the top of Meditation Mountain. You can't separate them. So mindfulness and kindness, the top of Meditation Mountain, they all come together. So you can actually go up thinking you're doing loving kindness meditation. Or you can go up Meditation Mountain thinking you're doing still meditation. Or you can go up Meditation Mountain thinking you're doing Vipassana meditation. It's the same mountain, the same path. When you go to the top, they all come together. That's why Sam, Vi, and the dog, they always go together. Does mindfulness naturally have an embedded kindness because it accepts all objects of awareness without judgment? If it really is proper mindfulness, it is unconditional mindfulness. Unconditional, just like unconditional love. You're mindful without any judgment. Valuing, embracing it. That's why I made the point of saying, be mindful and kind. Remember that simile of the 1,000-petal lotus this morning? It's mindfulness and kindness, like the light and the warmth of the sun, which open the lotus. And I know a lot of people are mindful, but they're not kind. Yeah, they're aware, but it's a forceful, it's an aggressive mindfulness. And that's why they never get far in meditation. So if you are being mindful, be soft and kind and happy mindfulness, not the hard stuff. Unfortunately, in some retreats it's like that. It's an unkind mindfulness. Be mindful. Sit up. What are you just doing? Were you aware? Where do you leave your shoes on the outside? What do you do? What are you doing right now? It's a very unkind mindfulness. And so a lot of times people get afraid. So real mindfulness has to be together with kindness, and then it works. Does one have to consciously add an element of kindness to one's practice of mindfulness to give the glue to keep awareness on the object? You do really have to deliberately add a bit of kindness, because as human beings we don't have enough kindness. And that's one of the reasons why meditation often doesn't work. The story, when I was in Sydney a couple of years ago teaching at a meditation conference, there was a professor from Stanford University who was doing research on mindfulness. And he did this experiment. He took a whole lot of psychology students. So actually, you get credits if you volunteer for these experiments. You know, it's just like doing an essay. You get credits for it. So he split the students up into two groups, which you have to do so to compare the results. He sent half the students to a meditation day. Now, we were passing the retreat for one day, mindfulness retreat. And the others he sent to a Californian spa at the university's expense. Massage, hot baths, jacuzzis. Because he wanted to find out what makes you more relaxed, the spa or meditation. And when the students came back and he gave them the test, the results were very convincing. The people who went to the spa were far more relaxed. So much for meditation. When I heard that story, everybody laughed. And he made the point, the reason was because the mindfulness was without kindness. Why do you get relaxed at the spa? Because someone is being really kind to your body. They're stroking it, warming it, soothing it. It's the kindness which relaxes you. So mindfulness together with kindness, that relaxes. And that's what's really important. That's why in this retreat, if you're tired, take a rest. You're not kind enough. If it hurts, move. If it sort of itches, scratch it. There you do. Well done. Good disciple. When you're kind, the meditation goes much deeper. Sometimes people think Ajahn Brahm is too kind. He's just soft. He lets us do anything. We want somebody stricter to force us, to make us meditate more. If that doesn't work, you get far deeper in a retreat like this, where kindness and mindfulness go together. So be kind and be mindful, and then you go very deep. So that is the last question, the last joke for tonight. So that's very, 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 very good. So now is the time for the three sadhus. Are you ready? Wait for it. Be patient. Because patience is a very important part. So I go for it. Sadhu. 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 Very good. So have a nice night.